welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, this is Jessica from Syosset Library Turn the Page podcast, and I have a very special guest today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Well, my name is Alan Asherman, and I'm a writer, a freelance writer. I'm a lifelong science fiction fan, and I first became a fan of Star Trek even before it was first aired. In 1966, I heard that Gene Roddenberry was going to be at the World Science Fiction Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. And I took the train there, and I was very happy at what I saw, because he brought with him the two pilots for Star Trek, Where No Man Has Gone Before, and a black and white print of The Cage, which was the first pilot. And nobody there could believe we were in a big room, and it was running a huge auditorium, and everybody there was instantly a convert of Star Trek, for Star Trek.
What were you familiar with before that Gene Roddenberry had done? I know he had an extraordinary life beforehand, but what drew
all
you?
All I knew was that he had written scripts for Have Gummel Travel under his name, Gene Roddenberry.
Right.
What I did not know at the time is that he had written a lot of scripts for a lot of favorite shows of mine under his pseudonym, Robert Wesley.
I didn't know he had a pseudonym.
Yes, he did. He was working for the police department in Los Angeles, and there was a department rule that you couldn't moonlight. So to get around that, he used a pseudonym of Robert Wesley. Wesley being his name.
That's what I was going to ask. Wow.
And he wrote scripts for, he was asked in an official capacity by the police commissioner of Los Angeles to be the liaison between the police department there and the producers of various detective shows, including Dragnet, Mr. District Attorney. And so he began to submit ideas for scripts to them too, and he wrote, and he had more sales, and he decided that from that, I think, that he would leave the police department and become a writer full time.
Beforehand, he was a pilot.
If you wrote a story introducing a man who started as a pilot, became a policeman, and then became a writer, it would be like, you know, one of those things that you see in a movie and you say, oh, come on, this doesn't happen. But it happened with him.
Yes. And he survived a crash, if I remember correctly.
He not only survived it, but he was the one who went for help.
Yeah.
And got people to help, not the survivors, which was very important, because this happened in a foreign country, and there were a lot of bandits at the time who probably would have taken advantage of the situation had Mr. Roddenberry not come back with reinforcements from the local soldiers and gotten the people out of their difficulty.
I mean, it's really extraordinary that, you know, and of course he went on to write about, to create Star Trek, which even today is still spawning spinoffs upon spinoffs and expanding into so many different things. And he, you know, himself had this career as a pilot, and, you know, did some heroic things. If my history is correct, so when Star Trek was coming out, I believe that Lucille Ball had something to do with making it to air.
Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz had bought Desilu Studios. Actually, they bought the studios and named it Desilu after themselves. And they had a pilot submitted to them, and that was Star Trek. An executive at Desi Lu named Oscar Katz championed the project and advised Lucille Ball to become more acquainted with it, and she did, and she liked it. She became a fan, and she was instrumental in getting NBC to pay attention to it as an offer for their network. Unfortunately, they turned down the first pilot, The Cage, but they liked it enough so that they commissioned a second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before, and that was what sold the series.
That's pretty amazing. Obviously, when people think of Desi Lu Productions and they think of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz, you know, they think like domestic sitcom, but it's great to hear just how, you know, they saw the potential in this and were willing to really go to bat for it. That was always kind of a fun little piece of Star Trek history for me.
Well, don't forget, Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz were also responsible for The Untouchables. And also Ben Casey was shot at Desi Lu.
So they were really much more versatile than people probably realize.
Yeah, I think the comedy came from their backgrounds, but their personal backgrounds and their show business backgrounds. But you can't run a studio if you stick to one genre. So they tried everything, and whenever they got an offering that sounded good, they went with it. A lot of their pilots didn't sell, as a lot of the pilots of most studios and producers don't really sell. There are hundreds made every year that are on the shelf somewhere and are almost never seen by the public.
So when Star Trek aired, so you've written several books about Star Trek. You've written the Star Trek Compendium for one?
Yes.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about what led you to that?
Yeah, I had been on the staff of a venture called the Giant Star Trek Poster Book, which was done in 1976 and 1977. I had been writing for it. And I was at the meeting with the editor and the publisher. And the publisher asked me, is there enough material on Star Trek to write a series of poster books? And I said, well, there are almost 80 episodes. You can write a poster book about each episode. You could ask the directors, the writers, the actors, what they would have wanted to see in it. You could ask the writers what subsequent scripts they would have written had they had the chance. You can examine each character in turn. And finally, the publisher was convinced there was enough material, and he gave the go-ahead. And I began to write, and on the staff were two interesting people, Doug Drexler, who later became a professional makeup artist. He did the makeup for the Dick Tracy movie.
Oh, yeah, the one with Madonna and Warren Beatty.
It wasn't much of a movie, but the makeup was fantastic.
The art, they definitely, if they got anything in that movie, the art and the makeup was beautiful. I mean, they certainly were able to capture that look of pop art.
Right, right. Also on the poster book writing staff was a young fellow named Jeffrey Mandel, who later became the art director on a wonderful TV series, Space Above and Beyond. So I was writing for this, and one day I got a call from the editor, Ron Barlow. Could I come to a meeting at Simon & Schuster? Someone had written a book called The Complete Book of Star Trek, and the editor of the project wasn't completely sure of the validity of the manuscript, so she wanted to show it to some Star Trek experts. So I went, and she showed me the manuscript, and the first page I opened up at random was The Enemy Within, the fifth episode produced. And he had said that the script was written by Richard Maybaum. Richard Maybaum was a writer. He had written for James Bond and for other endeavors, but he had never had anything to do with Star Trek.
Oh, no.
The writer of the episode was Richard Matheson. So I told her about this error, and she said, is that a serious error? I said, it's a very serious error.
I'd say so.
Well, I went through and I found a lot more errors. And finally, she looked at me very strangely and said, "Would you like to write this book yourself?" She had made the decision to throw the manuscript out and say to the writer, "No, thank you." And I thought for a few moments and I said, "Yes, I'd love to."
This was
before computers. That was really in 1980 that I went to the meeting. The book was published in 1981.
Got it. Okay.
And it went on to be published in 9 editions between 1983 and 1993. There were foreign editions in Great Britain, Germany, Italy, and Spain, I think, and Japan. And it wasn't easy because I wrote it, as I said, before the internet.
So how did you research then, just to make sure obviously you were able to open to the first page and say, that person was never an author for Star Trek. But how did that work?
What I set out to do was to do a book that would teach people who read it why Star Trek is atypical and exceptional and wonderful, and how generally it was put together. So what I did first, I had two friends in New Jersey who were fans, and they had the habit of using an 8mm motion picture camera to film the beginning and end credits of each Star Trek episode. So I went there and made detailed notes about the credits because there was no other way I could have seen them at that time.
Good friends to have.
Yeah. And I also did a lot of research. I bought many hundreds of index cards and started writing one fact on each index card, cross-referenced them with the episode titles and things like wonderful pieces of, I wouldn't say trivia. I detest the term trivia because trivia by its meaning implies that it's worthless material. But it's I wanted material that would teach people about the series. And so I made a list of, for instance, whenever costumes were used, whenever props were used, whenever sets were redecorated and used for other purposes. I noticed that Mission Impossible, which was also a Desilu show, had many actors and sets in common with Star Trek. So I kept making notes on things like that. And then I sat and thought about each individual episode in succession and made detailed notes of why I liked it, what the story was about, what it contributed to the overall continuity of the series. And after about a year's preparation, I had enough material to turn in and we began working on the book. And it was a lot of fun. And I had a lot of challenges because my copy had to be approved by Paramount at every turn. And I quickly learned that there were some idiosyncrasies in the way Star Trek was produced. For instance, a lot of the props and costumes were monster costumes, the Salt Monster, the Mogatu, were designed by a special effects artist named Wat Chong, who was a member of a special effects team called Project Unlimited. They did George Pal's Time Machine, The Outer Limits, and several other TV shows.
Cool.
But Wat Chong had never joined the union. So Paramount could never give him screen credit.
So how did that work when you were writing?
Yes. But I had mentioned that he was responsible for designing the phaser, the tricorder, the communicator, every important prop in the series.
All the iconic things that you think about when you think about Star Trek tech.
Yes. In fact, he designed and built the Romulan ship for Balance of Terror. And he did that over a weekend. That was his deadline.
Creative.
So I got into some arguments with Paramount. They wouldn't permit me to write these things in the manuscript. And ultimately, I think some of them did get in because others came in a later administration at Paramount and said, "Well, yeah, let's put these in." But it's a very comprehensive book, and it's said to be one of the best Star Trek books, and I this isn't my opinion. It is my opinion, but it's not my opinion alone. It's described by the publishers as the most thoroughly researched and complete Star Trek reference work ever published.
That's amazing. And I'm sure as a fan, it was probably, I mean, it was like, it was, I don't want to say a labor of love, but, you know, there was a lot of passion behind making sure that everything was done right.
Yes. As right as I could. And I'm sure there are some errors in it because nothing is ever perfect. But I tried my best and it was very well received. And I started going to the Star Trek conventions to talk about it. And I was also on the committee that put together the first New York Star Trek convention.
Oh, that's cool.
So we were all interested in the furtherance of Star Trek. We were people who loved the show, and when it went off the air, started to experience, I have to say, withdrawal symptoms because we loved it and we didn't want to be away from it. And one day at a meeting of the Lunarian Science Fiction Society, to which I belonged, and most of these people belonged, Elise Pines, who is now Elise Rosenstein, and I decided to go to Brooklyn College to find out what the interest would be in a Star Trek convention. We were giving a small talk for the science fiction club there. And we found that there was an incredible amount of interest and that we would have to have considerable security at such a convention because there would be a lot of people present. And that turned out to be the case. And it was covered by the press, and it was as you know, it led to many, many other Star Trek conventions.
What year was that?
I believe that was 1972.
Oh, wow. So when you first began, I mean, I am on a much, much smaller scale. I mean, I've been to several conventions. I've done New York Comic Con. I've done various anime conventions. I've done WonderCon out in San Francisco. And then the last few years, we've begun planning a small scale pop culture convention here at our library, and even a small scale one. I mean, organization is so much work. So how did you organize? Like, did you have a template? What did you have in your mind when you all began organizing this?
We had in mind a place for Star Trek fans to get together, talk about the show, and just experience a lot of stories, a lot of what made us each get interested in the show, why we loved it so much. And we contacted the actors. We contacted some of the people behind the scenes, Gene Roddenberry, of course. And we had a lot of panel discussions about the show. We got the clearance to show some episodes in 16mm. And it was a beautiful, beautiful weekend. And everybody had a wonderful time.
About how many people came?
Many people came. We lost track of how many hundreds. In fact, the New York City Fire Marshal at one point wanted to shut the convention down because there were so many people waiting in line for tickets and it was already overcrowded. But fortunately, we got around that and we were able to run the convention without turning too many people away.
That's great.
Yeah.
Were the panel discussions generally run by experts
Yes, the people at the discussions were the actors who were talking about their own part in the show. I remember George Takei, for instance, was very, very anxious to talk to the fans and communicate with
them. He's very fan friendly. He's certainly a presence, and he seems like a mainstay at a lot of conventions.
He's a fantastic communicator. He can reach people, and He has a very friendly presence, and he's very interested in so many wonderful, pertinent issues.
He's gone on to direct his own Broadway play about internment, and even write a graphic novel about it recently. So he's really, I mean, he's definitely constantly out there.
Yes, yes, and wonderfully so, and still is. And well, that was the first book, the Star Trek Compendium. And after the Star Trek Compendium, a year later, I got an idea for a book on the making of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
So
they had made the movie. They had already completed the movie. And I came in 1982 when the film was released. Before the film was released, actually, and said I'd like to do a book on it. And they gave permission for me to do the book, and Paramount approved the project. The catch was that I was told my deadline for delivering the complete manuscript and visuals for the book was less than a month away because of the date that it would open in the theaters. That was my window of opportunity. So the same day, I got permission to do it. I flew to Los Angeles and arranged all the necessary appointments with people. And I outlined the book on the day of my arrival in California and could never have done it without help from Harve Bennett, the producer of the movie, who opened his files to me and made sure that Paramount and Industrial Light and Magic gave me access to whatever it was I needed. In a very, very timely fashion because of a horrible deadline. And I had a friend who lent me office space. And that friend was Craig Miller, who just came out with his own book on Star Wars and his experiences on the set during the making of the first two movies.
So that's actually a question I want to ask about, like, so Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. So when they first released Star Trek as a movie, you know, and I know that there's a lot of Star Wars versus Star Trek, which I think is apples and oranges. You can like them both. I mean, you know, because Star Wars is a space opera, space western, and Star Trek is a very different creature.
Yes. Space opera is very different from science fiction.
But that doesn't make one not good or the other. It's just there's a difference.
Simply means they're two different categories.
Exactly. But when they released the first Star Trek movie, it didn't do obviously as well as the second. The second one is the one that a lot, like The Wrath of Khan, a lot of people really think about as, you know, the first big Star Trek movie. Could you talk a little bit about why Khan resonated more? And I also want to mention, because I don't know if a lot of people, you know, because a lot of people came into Star Trek at The Wrath of Khan. Khan had been a character in the original series in one episode, I think.
Yes, Space Seed, the 25th episode produced. And basically what happened with the first movie was that Gene Roddenberry, I think, got carried away with himself. He had a big budget. He wanted to make a spectacular movie. And I think along the way, several unfortunate things happened. Number one, the special effects were entrusted to a firm that had done a wonderful TV commercial, but that was the extent of their work. And Paramount entrusted them with the special effects of the movie on the basis of that one commercial. Unfortunately, it was too much for them to handle. And ultimately, Roddenberry and the director, Robert Wise, went to this installation and asked him, what have you done so far? And it had been almost nothing. They had done a lot of drawings, a lot of concepts, a lot of beautiful things, but almost no usable footage for the film had been shot at that point. And they had a deadline, too, because of a situation called blind bidding. Paramount had sold the movie on the basis of premiering it on a given specific date. So they took the special effects away and gave them to Doug Trumbull to do. And also Gene had decided to do a very spectacular story, but I'm afraid because of that spectacular story, the characters took a back seat. So there were a lot of lines, of course, a lot of dialogue from the characters, and particularly Spock, who wanted to remain on Vulcan initially and decided, I have to go back and help the people because of this great danger from this V'ger thing that's coming to eat all the planets in the galaxy. And because of this, a lot of the fans did not like the movie. I loved it because it was one of the few science fiction movies I'd ever seen about space travel in which the emphasis was not on the monster, the menace. The emphasis was on the body of men who were out there and why they had the qualifications to stop the menace, to solve the problem. And the editing of the movie was hindered, I think, partly because the studio felt they were spending all this money on the special effects. Cut out a lot of the dialogue and put in as many special effects as you can.
So it was more, it doesn't sound like the flow didn't exist.
No, it wasn't. It was a good movie, but not a Star Trek movie. Not as much of a Star Trek movie as it could have been, and that's why the fans did not like it as much.
So flash forward. Go ahead.
Paramount invited me to the premiere in Washington, and I went. And afterward, they had a dinner, and I sat next to Robert Wise, and I idolized Robert Wise's work because one of my favorite movies is The Day the Earth Stood Still. And I talked to him a lot about The Day the Earth Stood Still and a lot about Citizen Kane and a lot about the other movies he had done. But when I wanted to talk to him about the movie, he said, I don't want to discuss it. He came to terms with that later because he was asked by Paramount to contribute to the director's cut, which was on a DVD. But at that time, they had hired another editor to edit the release cut without telling him. And so Robert Wise found out the night of the screening, the night of the premiere, that it was not the cut that he edited together that was released. And he was very taken aback.
Yeah, that's painful.
Very painful. And especially for somebody who began his career as a film editor and for instance, he edited Citizen Kane.
And those are the films that you study when you go to film school. It's not, like he was an upstart, who had an independent film under his belt, which it still would have hurt. But, I'm sure that's painful.
So you fast forward to 1982 and Paramount has decided not to give the picture to Gene Roddenberry, but to find another producer. The producer they settled on was Harve Bennett, who had done a lot of television things, including some beautiful things. He created The Bionic Woman, and he did what I think was the best episode in that series, with Max the Bionic Dog. And it was full of love and full of suspense. He came on and he said, best course would to follow would be to study all of the episodes, pick one, and do a sequel to it. And the episode he settled on was Space Seed. And he called Ricardo Montalban and asked him if he was interested in doing it. And Montalban at first was very doubtful that he could do it because he had spent all of his time doing Fantasy Island, in which the challenge wasn't really acting at all. It was just being there and saying the dialogue.
Right.
So they talked him into doing it, and Nicholas Meyer, the director, was very, very patient. Not only with Shatner, who did not want to come to terms with the fact that he was getting older on film, but with Montalban as well, who needed a lot of confidence building and got it very early, and so they were able to do a beautiful movie. Now, that beautiful movie cost $15 million, which was a very small piece of the budget of Star Trek, the motion picture. So Paramount was very happy.
But it certainly transcended, I mean, the reputation of Wrath of Khan. It resonated. What worked? What do you think worked on that one for, I guess, the general public?
I think having a character directly from the first series and cutting down on the spectacle as much as possible and having it, most of it unfold from inside the Enterprise gave the opportunity to have great dialogue for the characters. You learn more about them, how they had changed, what motivated them. And it was like the audience torn from Star Trek because of its cancellation, suddenly coming back to it on a big screen, experiencing the people who they loved in the series, who they had learned to like episode after episode. And it had a beautiful music score by a young composer named James Horner, who later went on to do Titanic and many other scores. And unfortunately, he loved flying, and he perished when his own plane crashed.
Oh, that's too bad.
Many years later. But it was a beautiful movie, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
I was actually reading somewhere that they specifically did not want a John Williams type score for Star Trek.
They wanted a score that matched quality of the music in the original series. That's very high quality. But the music written for the series was not planned to have huge orchestras. There was a budget to keep to, and so they had a lot of imaginative composers, mainly Alexander Courage, who did the pilots and a few other early episodes. Courage writing music since the 40s, and he was a wonderful composer. And the best composer was Fred Steiner. Fred Steiner did a lot of Twilight Zone and a lot of, he wrote the theme to Perry Mason and scored some of the earliest episodes of that series. He wrote the theme Rocky and Bullwinkle, and anybody who can do the theme to both Perry Mason and Rocky and Bullwinkle
is talented.
Is talented. Yes.
Completely different animals, brain. Not even apples and oranges. They're apples
right.
And something completely different.
So they got James Horner to listen to the original scores, and basically they asked him to come up with a score applicable to a motion picture shown on a big screen, but compares in terms of motifs for each character, situation, like it was done in the TV series. And it helped the movie immensely. And so did the special effects done by Industrial Light and Magic.
Which is, obviously, I mean, they've done so many great things. So it sounds like they really went with the right company for that.
Yes, they were state-of-the-art.
Yeah.
They delivered what was needed for on a very tight deadline and no trouble doing it. And they were very innovative for one of the battle scenes, for instance. They constructed a miniature of the Enterprise that was made of wax and could be gradually melted during the scene. And it would look as if the ship was being heavily damaged. And it was, of course, it was melting. But it didn't look like it was being melted on screen. It looked like it was being damaged.
That's incredible.
And it was very, very, very wonderful stuff they did.
And then you had the storyline, and you had this. So you had Khan, who. What do you think it was about him as a villain, which really worked? Aside from him being, just a callback. Obviously, there was a reason they picked Space Seed as the episode they wanted to work with or work forward with.
Khan was a product of genetic engineering. he wasn't the friendliest guy in the world. It was not his goal to be a villain. It was his goal to bring humanity together under the goal of people who were mentally and physically more suited to govern a peaceful world, united. And that's what he set out to do. Unfortunately, this meant starting a big war before he could do that. And so that's why he was put into a sleeper ship and launched into outer space. But Ricardo Montalban was an amazing actor, and he managed to get a lot of very villainous, but a lot of also very likable characteristics into the character. And I think a lot of the credit for the show's success, the movie's success, belongs to Montalban and the performance that the that Nicholas Meyer got out of him as a director.
Yes, I was reading, a very short interview with him where, you know, he felt that a good villain had to do villainous things, but in their mind, it had to be coming from what they thought was the right place.
Well, also, he had fallen in love with Marla MacIvers and taken her to the planet so that she didn't have to be imprisoned in a Federation prison for helping them take over the Enterprise. But she had died terribly because of those little worms that burrow inside people's ears and eat their brains, the Seti eels. And so this warped him even further than he was originally warped. And he wanted only revenge from Kirk. Kirk, of course, had no way of knowing that the climate on Seti Alpha 5 would change so drastically so that it would become an inhospitable desert planet. He did not know this, but I've always suspected privately, this was never covered in the screenplay, but I've always suspected that Kirk never really reported Khan's presence to the Federation, because otherwise the Federation would have checked on him on the planet. And nobody came to check on him on the planet.
That makes sense.
And so he had lost his wife, and he had an infant son, and he blamed it all on Kirk for marooning him and his people there. And that was the basic conflict. Now, there was another conflict going on behind the scenes, because Leonard Nimoy at the time had decided he didn't want to be Spock anymore. So they wrote in a death scene for Mr. Spock. And
which is another iconic moment of that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And afterward, thank goodness, it was decided to bring him back when he came back into the fold and said, yes, I want more Star Trek. And they were able to write a script and do that. But I was out in Los Angeles researching Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, the book, the making of book. And I spoke to Leonard Nimoy, who gave me a very, very good interview, which is in the book. During the interview, I said, will you do another Star Trek movie? And he said, I think I would. I think I would now. And then I asked him what the words that he said, remember, what it meant. And he told me that it was basically a goof on his part, because the words in the script were remember me. And he did not want to say remember me like he was going to die. He said remember, and he left it at that. I said, doesn't that open an opportunity for the character that be brought back by the Genesis Ray? Because the casket was originally supposed to be fired into the sun, the casket bearing Spock's body.
Right.
But at the last minute, they had a screening. And at the screening, they had a very bad audience reaction to the shot of the casket going into the sun to burn up. So they edited this shot, and they stopped it at a certain point and rewrote it so that it went onto the Genesis planet. And they hurriedly filmed an extra scene before the film was released on the Genesis planet, panning around, showing the casket rest on the surface of the planet. And Leonard was very enthusiastic that maybe Spock could be brought back. So I don't know if I was the first to think of this, but I can say truthfully that I may have been responsible for the talks that led to the next Star Trek movie beginning, because Harve Bennett had been trying to go out to lunch with Leonard to convince him of the movie. And after that discussion with Leonard, he did in fact meet with Harve, and they did in fact agree to do the next movie.
That's incredible.
And, yeah, so it was an amazing thing. I never mentioned it in print because I didn't think I had the right to, not knowing the full story, and not really having any substantial proof of it either. So, but I'm saying it now because it happened,
and
I'm very proud of it.
And Spock is obviously a fan favorite, and you know, people were devastated at his loss. But I guess that's
I don't think there could have been a Star Trek without Mr. Spock.
No,
because Spock was the one factor that set Star Trek apart from any other science fiction series that had been done outside of episodic things. And anthologies like The Outer Limits, Twilight Zone. With Spock, you're able to look at human race as an outsider would see it. And that's a very valuable thing. And because Roddenberry's intention from the very beginning was to discuss contemporary social issues in the show, disguised, of course, as science fiction situations, you had to have an outsider giving his opinion to Kirk, who was the human being and the one who made the decisions. And meanwhile, there was also Dr. McCoy, whose cynical attitude also tempered Kirk's judgment.
And as far as the other alien races that were in it, you know, you have the Klingons, who were definitely, and the Romulans, you know, who were not logical and sort of cool characters like the Vulcans, kind of playing, you know, advocate to that. So it was nice to have that balance.
It's a very interesting situation because the Vulcans and the Romulans are described as once having been one race.
And then they split.
They split, and they split philosophically as well. The Vulcans deciding to purge their emotions, and the Romulans deciding to pursue warlike existences.
So I feel I agree with you. And, you know, Spock was certainly, I mean, iconic, as I'd said before. And, you know, just people could empathize with him. But he was like an ambassador to Vulcans in a way, because
also,
the audience were so connected with him.
Because he was half human, he had to find out where he was at. He really didn't know. He really wasn't sure. And there's that one line they discuss. I think his mother says it at home nowhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't really have a native world. He was torn between two. And throughout the show, we experienced his growth as a character. I'm not sure I would have handled it that way, but it did grow. His character did grow and never lost its appeal.
I definitely agree. And being a Voyager fan myself, there's a half Klingon character, B'Elanna Torres, who also sort of does a good job of, she's half human and half Klingon, which is not supposed to be cool and logical like a Vulcan, but also goes through a really, you know, interesting period of identity. And, you know, I mean, obviously, I don't think we would have had that without Spock's own existence and journey.
And that was definitely an offshoot of Spock.
Absolutely.
And so was Worf.
Yes.
So was Worf, who was a Klingon raised by Jewish parents on Earth. And you get these different ways of life incorporated into one person. And it gave the opportunity to have a lot of humor regarding Worf, but also a lot of very, very insightful judgments about matters of life and things.
And they also, the first Star Trek, there was, people of all races and all nationalities working together. I remember hearing an interview with Whoopi Goldberg about how amazed she was that there was an African-American woman on, as a character and not playing a maid or somebody's, and that really made an impression on her. So,
very early in the series, Nichelle Nichols became disappointed at the fact that she was standing there saying hailing frequencies open over and over, acting afraid when the script, but doing little else. So she wanted to quit the show. At about that time, she was invited to a function at which she met Martin Luther King. She didn't know she was going to be meeting him. A spokesman came up to her and said, Ms. Nichols, a big fan of yours is here and wants to meet you. So she said, oh, bring him over. And it was Dr. Martin Luther King. And when she told Dr. King that she wanted to quit, Dr. King said, you mustn't, because you have no idea what you're doing for our people. And he explained. And she understood immediately. And so she forced herself to stay. And that's just becoming common knowledge now. So it was a very, very important contribution that she made.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Your expertise has been amazing. And just getting some of these inside notes is great. Thank you for lending your voice and your expertise and just chatting about this with us.
And I haven't even started on the Star Trek interview book yet.
Oh my God. Could we come back to that on a later episode?
Sure.
So thanks again for coming. I welcome you back anytime. This is Jessica at Turn the Page Podcast, Syosset Library. And once again, my guest is
Ellen Asherman, and thank you for having me.
And I'm going to close this chapter of Turn the Page.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.